right, welcome to a Friday afternoon edition of Congress Two Beers In. I'm Matt Glassman, Senior Fellow at the Government Affairs Institute. And with me is my colleague, Josh Shooter, also a Senior Fellow at the Government Affairs Institute. How you doing, Josh?
I'm doing all right, Matt. How are you?
Good. Big week in Congress on a lot of fronts. Did you vote in the on the Virginia gerrymandering amendment?
I did. I did vote for the agenda, the Virginia gerrymandering amendment. And this has been an interesting dynamic. It's sort of sad to watch in a lot of regards that we've gotten here, and that you have two parties that are going to the nth degree of hardball because they feel like it's the only way to protect their right to exist within the government. And it brings me to a lot of things. There was some kind of like back and forth and some grumbling in Congress about the Virginia vote, because it potentially expands the map for Democrats from 6 votes to 10 votes in the Senate, which is like, that's a big jump. I mean, you've seen Republicans knock out some seats in North Carolina. You've seen them knock out Missouri and Arkansas. But like the big gains, outside of Texas have been California and Virginia. And it's been interesting to watch, and you've seen some grumbling about it or whatever. And one of the things that strikes me about this is that maybe this new equilibrium will hopefully get us closer to something that's better, right? Because in many ways, what had been going on is that, Republicans have been playing really strong hardball tactics, like, gerrymandering, doing all these things, maybe changing voting rules and stuff like that. And Democrats have been like the ones kind of being like, hey, let's do good government stuff. And they've been taking it in the teeth for a while, to be quite honest. They've just been sitting down while all these things have happened. And this has been a significant shift since Trump 2.0, where we've seen Democrats be more aggressive on this front. And I'm almost hopeful that this kind of terrible like hardball cycle that we're in actually does bring about good reforms on the other end, right? If you have two parties that are both like going toe to toe, doing everything they possibly can, and extending hardball to the ninth and tenth possible degree, hopefully this brings us back to a place where maybe redistricting reform is on the table, because everybody recognizes how terrible this is for representation and just general fairness with any given state. Like, just because like a party dominates a state doesn't mean that that state should have no representation for the minority party, right? Even the most dominant party that we have in the entire country, like even the most dominated states, is still 65-35 or 60-40, right? I mean, we're talking almost a third or more, right? Or almost, half or two-fifths of the state are from the minority party, and they deserve representation just like everybody else does.
Yeah. I mean, there's such an obvious collective action problem here. That, I vote against the amendment on principle, but I totally understand the logic for voting for it. And I don't begrudge the Democrats for doing it, right? It's the obvious move to counter what the Republicans are doing. And, I think that the problem for me is that basically everyone's going to do this, and you're going to end up with it being roughly a wash. I think it's, hilarious that it backfired on the Republicans, and the Democrats will probably end up a little bit ahead on this. I think that's hilarious. But ultimately, like, it's going to come out close to a wash, except that everyone's going to have more gerrymandered districts. And like, that's not great, right? Like, I thought it was a good move forward in Virginia when we passed the bipartisan commission plan, and the maps they came up with after 2020 were 6-5 Democrats. I think the Democrats would probably pick up a seat anyway, so they'd probably be like 7-4. And I think that sort of like authentically represents Virginia in some ways in Congress. And shifting that to 10-1, it's not great. It's not the end of the world, but I agree with you. If this spurs sort of future reforms, then I think it's probably a good thing. And there's two obvious reforms, one easy one and one harder one. The easy one is for Congress to just ban partisan gerrymandering and force bipartisan commissions onto this in the states. And you may get that. That's the way you solve a collective action problem, is you have a heavy from the top enforce something. Could it happen? I think you're right that it's gonna, get Republicans a lot more curious about this. I don't know if they'll get there. I don't know if Democrats will want them to get there at this point. The other reform you can do is, at any stake and at any time, if Congress would lift the ban, is get rid of single member districts and go to some sort of proportional representation in a state. That there's a federal law right now that requires single member districts. It's there for a good reason. If you go to like at large districts, you can wash away a racial minority very easily in a state. And that was sort of the impetus for it. But, if Congress lifted that and a state could just divide its members by proportion, then you could wash away all this, including the battles over the lines. I don't think it's great, when North Carolina draws a map that's incredibly tilted to the Republicans. I don't think it's great when Virginia does it the other way. But in the context of a battle over this, I totally get why the Democrats are doing it, and it makes sense to do it. And therein sort of lies the problem, because if you're just doing this as sort of a partisan hardball would be one thing, but it does end up in a bad spot at its new equilibrium in which people get a worse quality representation, right? And people don't think about this, but 40% of the voters in California are Republicans, and 47% of the voters in Texas are Democrats, right? And that's not nothing. That's a huge, millions of people who are effectively sort of getting diluted in their representation in the national government. So it passed by a pretty thin margin. And I think there were some recriminations we saw among the Republicans who didn't put as much money into it as you might have thought they would. The amendment did not do as well as Harris did in 2024 in Virginia. I think Harris won by 6 or 7 in Virginia, and the amendment only won by maybe 2. Some of that might have been people like me, who voted for Harris and then voted on principle against the amendment.
I mean,
Might
it's
have
like,
been turnout for
the
angry people. Yeah.
most recent election, right, was the governor and statewide elections where Democrats looked a landslide in Virginia, right? I mean, Spanberger won by what, 17 in Virginia or 15? It was a huge margin. And this is a big step back. And I think it's just everybody sort of reflects like the kind of distasteful nature of
Yeah.
this type of process.
One thing that really bothers, see, I don't have a problem with hardball politics, and I actually prefer the politician who plays hardball, doesn't apologize for it, and doesn't pretend they're not. It's the people dressing this shit up in like fairness or vote rigging, on the other side that really just bothers. It's power politics, right? People just come out and say it. Like, we want more seats. They're trying to fuck us, so we're gonna fuck them. I have much more respect for that. It did bother me a little. The way Virginia's set up, where it's not like the political actors doing the fucking here. They have to actually ask the voters to go in and do it. And trying to wrap this up in sort of idealism, it strikes me as silly. If you want to say like they're trying to screw us, so we have to screw them, I'm all for that. But like even the way it was worded, right? Should the Constitution of Virginia be amended so that we can adopt congressional to restore fairness in the upcoming elections, right? The one thing that about it that's interesting to me is
Well,
how.
just to that point, like I think what this is interesting is that this highlights the sort of like disjuncture. We're doing this at the state level because of national politics, right? That's the thing. We're doing this at the state level because of national politics. And this is just mind-boggling, right? I mean, a political scientist in 1960, what the hell is going on here? Like, who cares about this? And it's
It
just the
really
reflection of how
is.
nationalized our policies have
Yes.
become, that is driving state-level politics in Texas, in California, in Missouri,
It's
in
an
Arkansas, in
incredibly,
Virginia.
incredibly national view of politics to behave this way at the state level. That's fine. Like, there's nothing wrong with that per se. I do worry a little. I wrote about this week. I worry a little about turning state elections into proxies for national politics. Like, I don't think it's great if the election of the governor and the state legislature is all about how you feel about national politics. And the best example of that, and I wrote about this week, is the 17th Amendment. One reason to directly elect senators is because the state legislative elections had started to turn into battles over who was going to get to appoint the senators. That's not what you want. You want state elections, in theory, to be about state public policy, hopefully, right? We already have a lot of people voting in their state elections for how based on how they feel about Donald Trump or Joe Biden, right? And that's fine. Voters can do that, but I don't think it's great for state level politics. And if the state elections were to become sort of constant battles over who's going to get to redraw the maps mid-district, I don't think that's great either. That doesn't change anything this week, right? Like, there's an obvious reason to do this, and the Democrats were gung-ho to do it, and they've done it now, and they're gonna, I don't know to what chance it is that the control of the House comes down to 3 seats, but it could. So, there's a lot of incentive there on the part for the party to do it.
Yeah, I mean, my view of this is just bad for representation. I mean, like the whole reason the House exists is is for representation. Like, it's the one directly elected body at the signing of the Constitution for this exact reason. It is the one place that is closest to the people. And as soon as we get into this era where state level politics or representational decisions are being made based on national political needs, you're getting away from the whole purpose of the House, right? It's not about how many seats you have, right? At the end of the day, I mean, I get why political parties have an interest in that, and I get why they want to try to expand that. At the same time, like, we're here because we want like local interests to be in the national legislature, and we're getting further and further away from that every time
Yes.
we make one of these decisions.
Yes. If you want to nationalize sort of the House in that sense, you could wipe away sort of the even idea of the state lines and just have national proportional representation. And a lot of countries do, right? And there's nothing wrong with that. And it might be a good alternative system, but sort of shoehorning that into the district system doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. And that's sort of the direction we're headed here. I do think that, like, you can see this in other places too, right? You can see this in the Electoral College. Where states are free to sort of assign their votes who they want, and every state essentially assigns them winner take all. And again, this is a collective action problem. If Virginia assigned its electoral college votes, which has 13, proportionally, it would always come out 7-6 one way or another, pretty much, maybe 8-5. But that would dilute sort of the power of Virginia in the presidential election. And so they don't. And that, you know, the collective action problem with the gerrymandering isn't quite that bad. You can imagine if the district rule wasn't in place from Congress that it could get that bad, that a state could decide it was going to have 11 at-large seats in Virginia, and the Democrats were going to win all 11. And I don't think that would be better. That would be worse. But, you know, states are under pressure, and there are incentives for them to do these sorts of things. And so, you know, you said something funny to me once that I rewrote this week. I didn't give you credit for it, but I should have rewrote it. Like, about norms. It was like you're violating norms. And it's like, no, in gerrymandering, the norm is you screw the other party, right? That's the
right.
norm. Like,
yeah.
Virginia, like, broke the norm by going to the bipartisan commission. What we're doing right now is going back to the norm, right? The norm is you screw the other party.
This is the norm. Yeah, this is definitely the norm in many respects. It would be great if it wasn't. I mean, like, you know, there were a lot of these good government reforms coming out of, like, the progressive era. I do, you know, at times when we have, like, such heightened political contestation and polarization, and, like, the partisan gamesmanship has just gotten, like, sort of off, out of control. I do wonder if we're entering some sort of, like, good government phase. And it'd be great to go to something like proportional representation. It's not like America doesn't have experience with that. Several states adopted it, you know, after the Constitutional Convention. To have some, I mean, they eventually got rid of it, right? But they had some sort of, like, proportional system. And, you know, it would be a lot better and a better reflection of that, of state and state interests. And if there's anything that's, like, plaguing Congress, it's just a lack of state and local interests that are coming to the fore, right? I mean, everything is controlled at the national level. You know, the parties are national, like the network fundraising networks are national. The media environment is national. The leaders of the parties are extremely national, right? I mean, you know, we have Thune and Johnson, and they are chamber leaders who are in charge of national parties. And you don't see the kind of, like, state idiosyncrasies that you used to in Congress. And that's the thing that I think is the institution is a dire need of, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, proportional representation, even if, you know, again, for Congress would have to undo the single district rule, single member district rule that they have in place in federal law. They could do that. If a state were to try that, weird things would happen, because not only would you get the gerrymandering would be done and you'd have proportions, but proportional representation also allows more than two parties very easily, because you no longer have to get the 50% in each district. And so I think in the larger states, you would immediately see the rise of sort of ideological parties across the spectrum. It's always one of the sort of disappointments to me of federalism in America has been that states have not tinkered with their governing systems at, you know, in the big picture, right? It's totally within the
Save
Constitution.
Nebraska.
What?
Save
what?
Nebraska.
Yeah, same in Nebraska, but, like, you know, any state at any time could try a parliamentary system, right? And just elect the state legislature and have them pick a prime governor or whatever the hell they call it in the Canadian provinces that do it that way. And that would be interesting to see. And a state could try proportional representation for their own legislatures too. And we haven't had a lot of that level of sort of laboratory of the states. We get a lot of, like, laboratory of the state style stuff on policy, but on actual governing systems, aside from sort of things like ballot initiatives and that sort of stuff, you don't see as much variation in the states as I thought you might have. Sort of the received wisdom of the 18th century British system has been very strong in the United States and has sort of attached almost universally. You mentioned Nebraska having a unicameral legislature, but that's really the only sort of big picture difference we have in the whole country, except, you know, maybe like the Napoleonic Code being the legal basis in Louisiana or things like that. All right, enough about the electoral side. What do you make of what's going on right now in the House? There's a whole lot of stuff sort of sitting on the burner for Mike Johnson. Must be ready to have the worst week of his life next week.
Well, I mean, he's delayed it for as long as he could. I mean, like any good Republican speaker, he's put off the decision as long as he can. And here we are now. It's stacking up real big. You know, the House of Representatives, you know, I guess we'll start with the shutdown and what's going on there, because that's the sort of big pressing news. Republicans passed the the budget and the Senate to start reconciliation just recently. So they've now got that process in place. And now the Senate is passed it along to the House, and the House is like, well, it looks like it's going to fail. And in many ways, this is kind of normal because Republicans have not really had majorities to appropriate dollars for the federal government. It's just a little surprising given the gravity and nature of the shutdown, right? I mean, this is the Department of Homeland Security. This is a top administration priority. And they're not able to deliver an appropriations bill in line with what the administration has been seeking. And in addition to that, like opposing the reforms that Democrats have been calling for in ICE and CBP. So it is surprising in that regard. It's kind of like normal budget politics that they don't have a majority, or they don't think they have a majority. How long that actually persists, I don't know. I don't know that we're going to see Republicans like not funded at all, but it is sort of, it's definitely shocking that it right out the gate, you've already got problems, and we're back to the place where Republicans may struggle to find the majority.
Yeah, I'm actually quite surprised that they don't have a majority for this. Essentially, what's in the Senate budget version would essentially set up 3 years of funding for ICE, CBP, and other sort of Republican priorities within the budgets. And the grumbling in the House is mostly that there's not more in here, right? They want to use reconciliation to do more things, more tax cuts, more other stuff. But this, I thought, looked like a package that on its face you would expect almost full Republican support in the House, which is what they need, of course. But this is, this game of sticking annual appropriations in the reconciliation bills, I think, has unlocked a treasure chest that both parties are going to find hard to resist. One thing you're doing here is you're just front appropriating for priorities of the Republicans, annual appropriations, through what is likely to be a divided Congress. So they will not have to fight with the Democrats as much over the annual appropriations for DHS in the next 2 years. And I think that realization that ship has sailed out on the reconciliation boat is going to be very tempting for majority parties in future trifectas to sort of advance appropriate for things they like. And this has been building. We saw some of this in ARPA. Right, a little bit Inflation Reduction Act, obviously in the One Big Beautiful Bill, you saw this, and now you're seeing it again. And it's just very tempting for a party to say, okay, we're gonna have two tracks of things. We're gonna have the bipartisan annual appropriations process. The appropriators like that. But for the stuff that's really core to our party, we're gonna get this going for multiple out years just in case we lose control of the House, which is a very common thing in the, second Congress of a presidency.
Yeah, and this is one thing that is really interesting because what we have here is a situation where the Appropriations Committee has really lost power and control over spending. The appropriations are not normally stuck in reconciliation bills, and there was this sort of belief, and I see it out there in the the internet, Twitterverse or whatever you want to call it. Where, oh, we don't do appropriations in reconciliation because it's against the law. And that's actually not true, right? There's nothing in there that says you can't stick appropriations into a reconciliation bill, which is why they've done it. It's just really straightforward. You say we're going to put these things and we're going to appropriate for these potential purposes. It's not complex. But what had been holding them back forever was the appropriations committees saying that you will absolutely not be putting this stuff in reconciliation bills because that's our job. Right. We control that money. We're in control of that decision. And we're not going to be doing this because when you shift these appropriations into reconciliation bills, it's authorizing committees that are putting the money and the legislation together, which means appropriation committees are not part of the spending process. I mean, this is a huge, huge shift in how Congress does the money decisions, right? And as more of these decisions get put into appropriations, when it just becomes politically unfeasible or more difficult to do, the Appropriations Committee itself is going to start hollowing out, right? Its power is
It's
going to
also,
wane.
yeah.
It's going to its influence is going to wane, and also bipartisan deal making on government spending is going to decline because this is still protected by the filibuster in the Senate. And all of a sudden, you're talking about just partisan lawmaking across the board.
Yeah. It's also going to make it even tougher to talk about this stuff. It's already a bunch of confusing terminology, but one thing I've noticed that's hilarious is we used to call annual appropriations, discretionary appropriations, right? Things that Congress did through the Appropriations Committee on an annual basis that expired. And then we called the stuff that wasn't that was done by other committees, mandatory spending, right? This was spending controlled outside of the normal appropriations process. And we usually thought of that not just as a distinction of where it's done, but also a functional distinction, that the annual appropriations ran government agencies and government programs, and the mandatory spending was sort of the entitlement things, things that by law you were formulaically entitled to. So security, veterans benefits, unemployment benefits, things like right. that.
Yeah,
now,
it was very simple to understand because like there's a law, there's a formula. Right. If you qualify, the money comes out of the treasury to you, right? It was simple.
And
was
so
simple
where thing. It happened was different. And we decided the name for it, either annual appropriations discretionary or mandatory spending. Other committees did that. And now it's like blown up in the most ridiculous way because we're putting annual appropriations, right, to run government agencies into reconciliation bills controlled by other committees. And that is being called by CBO mandatory spending because of where it's coming from. But functionally, it's discretionary spending. And so it's like, I could never get people straight on this before. And now it's just game over, right? Game over, man. Like
it's,
trying
it's
to like
funny
even have. Kevin McNellis. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was talking to somebody at the Department of Defense in one of our classes like a few couple weeks ago. And they're like, I got this guy comes up to me. He's like, here goes your mandatory spending. He's like, what is that? It's like, is it really mandatory spending? And I was like, I just sort of explained to him, like, yes and no. Like it's basically what used to be discretionary was just like it came from an appropriations bill, right? Functionally, it's the same thing, though, right? It's just money that. Yeah. You know, you have budget authority from the treasury, right? It's not mandatory, same as discretionary, but it's just budget authority from the treasury.
Now they're calling it mandatory, right? Even though it doesn't appear like it has dollars attached to it instead of formulas. And, you know, the other thing is that I'm very nervous about, and I think they're going to get this right, but they hadn't yet, is that when annual appropriations, when discretionary money goes in these reconciliation bills, Congress needs to be careful that they attach the same oversight strings to it that are in the discretionary appropriation annual bills. And they made this mistake in OBBA, and DHS was claiming that the oversight provisions that were in the annual bills for allowing members to go into ICE facilities on no notice and stuff weren't in the Big Beautiful Bill, and therefore money that they were spending from the Big Beautiful Bill didn't have to follow those requirements. And like, that's technically probably right, although I think they're actually at those ICE facilities spending also money from the annual bill. So I think they were wrong on whether they had to let the members in. But it was absolutely true that the authorizing committees, when they piled this money up, didn't follow through with the same sort of limitation riders and oversight provisions that the appropriators are just – they just do as a baseline bipartisanly, right? And so I think they need to make sure they get that right.
Because,
if they go to do this, right?
Because authorizers can't write appropriations bills. They have no experience doing that. I was talking to an appropriator a little while ago. They're like, they wrote a crap bill. They're just like going through like the didn't do this. It's like, this is basic stuff. Like, why isn't this stuck in there? There's like no report language on this thing. It was like.
Man, and another thing is that like the authorizers, when they write those reconciliation bills, because it's formulaic, they don't do it by account. Right. And so even the stuff in the Big Beautiful Bill for like CBP, it's like, oh, the secretary of DHS can have $70 billion to spend on this crap. Right. It's like not even how do you even crosswalk that to the accounts at Treasury? There's a lot of things. There's nothing damning here. This can be done. I don't think it's a great idea, but they're doing it now and they can fix all this. But there's a lot of technical details here that I think are blowing things wide open for future administrations. Number one being doing annual appropriations on a 3-year basis, right? Yeah. If you want to talk about like lack of oversight, like you're just shipping that money off to DHS now with very little chance of clawing it back in that 3-year period. People have for long been against biannual appropriations, doing 2-year appropriations for precisely this reason. And now here we go, we're doing 3-year appropriations for some things.
Yeah, I know. It reminds me of like the kind of breakdown in appropriations in like the 1870s through like up until 1920, right? Where all of a sudden authorizing committees started coming in, and because they didn't like the decisions that appropriators were doing, appropriators were coming in, they were just like pushing out bills that were too low. They got a bipartisan group together, and all of a sudden, like, transportation committee is going to take this bill. And it wasn't the transportation committee at the time, but they just basically took the appropriations bill from the appropriators and then never gave it back, right? And all of a sudden, you had authorizing committees who were doing the appropriating for a long period of time until the 1920 amendments came and like rejiggered the appropriations process so that the appropriations committees got all their bills back. You can see that you can see politics kind of breaking the process, right? We've seen this before, and the budget process has been broken by partisan polarized politics. Now we're seeing the appropriations process getting broken by polarized politics, it's just a further hollowing out of the appropriations committees. Other committees have arguably more responsibility, but all this is being done at the party leader level. So, I mean, again, committees are just kind of drawing by the wayside as more and more of this breaks through. But it's interesting. all of this is happening at a time when the parties are sort of breaking down on appropriations by themselves, right? Democratic Party can't appropriate by itself. It needs Republican votes. Republican Party can't appropriate by itself. It needs Democratic votes. I mean, that's in the House, right? That's not, Republicans just don't have majorities for this type of stuff too, historically. And so like the kind of dance where we eventually, like we threaten first shutdown and we eventually come back to a bipartisan agreement, I don't know how effective that's going to be at funding the government every single year. It's going to get very, very dicey. On top of the fact that you're just empowering the president too much, right?
I think that's another, that's another thing that I think is starting to become clear to a lot of people. It's been clear to me for a long time. That is, the more you streamline the ability to do partisan legislating in Congress, the more that goes in reconciliation bills, the more that gets around the filibuster, that empowers the administration, right? The administration is never in the minority, right? They always want things to be able done as quick as possible in Congress. And they have their veto, right? They can always stop things dead in its tracks if they don't like it. What the filibuster does is let the Senate stop administration things in their tracks. Does it cause problems for the majority? Sure, but it definitely will help the president here. It also makes me just generally sad for the appropriators. The Appropriations Committee not only is forced to be bipartisan because of the filibuster, but also attracts sort of people who are there to get to yes and compromise, right? Independent of how liberal or conservative they are. I think of both DeLauro and Cole as people who, as individual members of Congress, are not moderates. They just aren't. But they have a moderate temperament about how you go about doing things in Congress. And that is, you try to get to yes by making realistic compromises with the other side based on, the layout of the hand you're dealt. And that's to me a good thing in a legislature, right? And when you hand off the decisions about appropriations to partisans who only need to get the majorities, you're going to get nasty, nasty partisans getting to nasty, nasty majorities a lot of time, rather than people like Tom Cole and DeLauro saying, "We disagree, but we got to get the yes, let's do it."
Right. And your point is that the fact that you're not like moderates by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, DeLauro is hardcore into the Progressive Caucus, right? Tom Cole has been very conservative, like his entire career in Congress. But they understand how to get there, right? I mean, they have like a kind of mature ability to just sit down, hash out agreements like, I'm here, you're here, where are we going to give? How are we going to get the yes? And that temperament is sadly lacking in so much of the process these days. And you're seeing it right now on the floor, where all of a sudden, the Senate bill that's been passed and sent over to the House is already dead on arrival. But short of that, what else did you want to talk about in the House? We got FISA that is coming down the pike.
I mean, I do want to say one of the things. Like, I do think that like people make a mistake about what it means to be a moderate, because there's lots of different ways you can be a moderate. I think, most people, they think about moderates, they think about people have middle grounds on policy issues. But I think in Congress, a very important type of moderate is someone who likes to compromise, right? Who likes half a loaf better than sort of banging their fists on the table and getting an election issue because they don't get their way. And so those sorts of moderates tend to end up in places like the Appropriations Committee, in general. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Let's talk about FISA. I don't know a lot about FISA substantively. I do know that it's a nightmare every time they try to reauthorize Section 702, which is the provision of FISA that has to do with information gathering of foreign intelligence that happens to sort of be caught on conversations with Americans, so that you get Americans and things they're saying in sort of electronic communications or digital telephony communications being swept up without a warrant. And this is a constant battle in Congress to reauthorize this. And right now, Mike Johnson has proven he doesn't have the votes, right? One nice thing about price discovery in the House is you very quickly learn if you have the votes or not. And he did not have the votes last week. And so they're coming around for another bite of the apple this week. And I, it get to me, it gets to the weird distinction of what it means to try and pass a rule versus what it means to try to get a majority on the floor. And sometimes you get caught in a spot where you don't have the votes to get like a suspension. You don't have a two-thirds bipartisan majority. But if you could get the other party, some of them, to go along with you, you might have a bare majority, but they won't help you pass the rule. And so you just kind of get trapped. And one question is why they don't help you pass the rule if they like the bill. And another is like, how do you deal with this? And Mike Johnson probably doesn't have a good answer to either of those questions right now, but you get caught in this situation. And sometimes it's because the minority knows if your rule fails, you might have to come give them more goodies, in order to entice them to build a majority or help you. And sometimes it's because they want you to crash and burn and are just going to like let you twist in the wind until you can show what you're going to do, and maybe it's making you look politically inept. But in either case, they're kind of stuck right now until they can find a partisan majority to pass their rule.
All right. So one of the other issue that Mike Johnson has was this, is that when he tries to bring a rule to the floor and he works with Democrats to get it across the line, he it nearly costs him his job every time he does this, right? I mean, whether he's working with Democrats in the Rules Committee, right, because he might have to, or whether he's doing it on the floor, like, you know, conservatives go absolutely nuclear over this sort of stuff. And it's really odd to see, because this is an obvious thing that has to happen, but Mike Johnson is in a spot where he has to be a broker but can't be. Like, the politics of his right flank will prevent him from being a broker in many respects. And I, you know, more and more, I wonder why Republican speakers insist on having so much influence and power. You know, you can imagine a situation where they're like, ah, you know what? Let the chamber decide who's going to be on the rules committee, or let, like, the party decide who's going to be on the rules committee. There's some other, like, bargaining process rather than being like in control, you know, pseudo in control of it.
I mean, and Johnson, has very much relied on the White House and Trump to come in and play the heavy when they need to get this stuff done and sweep up those last bunch of votes. And the White House has done a decent job of that this Congress.
They've done a much better job this Congress of doing that, for sure.
And some of that is the White House is better at this. Some of it is that I think they have a more pliable set of targets to go after, but they have done a good job at it. It does make Johnson like utterly beholden to the White House in a way. I can't remember a previous speaker being sort of so tied to the president. I don't obviously I don't have a super long history of having good memories of various speakers, but when you get Johnson out there, like, and it's not just Congress stuff, right? You get Johnson out there like running cover for Trump on like ridiculous Trump war claims and things like that, that just are quite, I've our friend Philip Wallach loves to say that Johnson works for Trump. Right, in a way that Thune doesn't, and he owes his job to Trump. I mean, Trump was definitely the heavy who got him across the finish line in the speakership election, and also tamped down the sort of would have been pseudo revolt in the nomination in the conference. And so, I really think for at a working level, Johnson really is sort of beholden to Trump in a way that I think makes him sort of a clown and sort of have to like make himself look ridiculous a lot in public, but as a functional matter, I'm not sure he could ever escape that box anyway right now. And so I don't feel bad for him because I don't typically feel bad for politicians, but I totally understand the dilemma he's in. And when people are like, well, Johnson should just tell the White House to take a walk. Like, I don't really think he can. Like, that's really
No.
not in the cards for Johnson, right? He's kind of stuck in the play he's in, and he's not particularly deft at handling it, but you do see him hold these ridiculous press conferences where it just seems like he's closer to White House spokesperson than he is to Speaker of the House sometimes, and that's
Yeah.
not great.
No, it's not. Because, you know, you want your legislative leader to be a leader in the legislature. You know? And in many respects, like, Johnson can't be because of the politics of the Republican Party. And, you know, we give Johnson a hard time. I don't think any Republican speaker can really get out of this dilemma at the current moment, right? With Donald Trump in the White House and the kind of hold that he has on the base, I don't know that there's a Republican speaker who wouldn't be in this position. Now, the Senate is a fascinating example because Senator Thune was elected majority leader precisely because he was not the person that was going to be as closely tied to the president, right? The Senate really did want to protect its prerogative, and I don't think President Trump really helped himself out when, like, before he's even in office, he's talking about recess appointments, right? He's like, you know what, the first thing the Senate should do is should give up its power to the personnel power to me. That'd be fantastic. I mean, that's not a great, like, there are senators who are like, ah, yeah, I'm on board, but, like, many of them are like, ah, I don't think so. I'm
So
not really on
one
board with that,
feature of
but.
this, one feature of this is that the election procedures are different in the House and Senate. The House as a whole obviously votes for Speaker, and that's a public vote of the entire House, and so it's quite clear everyone votes. The Senate, of course, does
Right,
not
you need
have a
218
constitution.
in the House to
Right.
become speaker. You need 26 in the Senate to become majority leader.
And it's a secret ballot vote too in a private caucus meeting, and so. You wonder if you flip the procedures. Like, I actually think that I'm not sure what would happen in the House if the vote on the speakership was not public. Obviously, it would have it'd
Well,
be different.
keep in mind, this is it used to be that way, right? The organizing caucus, the idea that you went into caucus, you voted for the person got became the speaker nominee, and then you all decide to go there and support them on the floor, whether you like them or not, right? That whole norm, that process that had made speaker elections like very pro forma for most of the last 150 years or so. That's broken, right? And that norm has really just totally and totally utterly transformed the speaker and the election of the speaker, and therefore like the kind of political ties the speaker has, right? It's almost like the House has created a situation just by virtue of its politics by tying it closer to a co-partisan president.
Yeah. I mean, I think that one thing that undoubtedly has helped Trump this time around rather than his first term is that Sununu and Johnson may not love Trump, but they certainly are more amenable to Trump than McConnell and Ryan were. And they do not have, there is not sort of a large vocal contingent of Republicans in the House or the Senate now that are skeptical of Trumpism and Trump's policies the way there were in 2017, when you had sort of a very outspoken set of senators, Senator Flake, Senator Corker, even Senator Lee to a certain degree, Senator Cruz to a certain degree. And those people have either left Congress and been run off, or they've changed their tune to sort of match the times of their party. And so it's a much more amenable Congress to the White House this time around, even before you get to the White House being more skilled, or Johnson and Thune being somewhat more amenable, certainly than McConnell and Ryan were to Trump and his policies.
Yep. Well, I'm all for a Congress that is going to work with the administration, but it's kind of taken to an extreme, right? The Congress really does need to like reassert its independence in a way. But and to your point, like I don't actually see that happening, right? We're seeing this a lot. This is another thing that's popping up. Like, why isn't Congress like quote unquote doing something, right? We're having all these executive actions, whether it's war powers or something like that, and Congress is not stopping it, right? And yeah, it's yes, this is an issue, but one, Congress is doing things, right? They're voting down the war powers resolutions, for example. So it's kind of like tacitly approving the war in one way or another. But the other part of this is that the constituencies of the of independent legislators and the president are just substantially overlapped now in a way that they hadn't been previously. And in many ways, the incentives of the legislative branch and the president have become more intertwined as Congress has become more nationalized. And that's not great in a situation where you're trying to create a separation of powers. It's good for governing theoretically, right? If you have unified government, but it's bad for kind of creating an independent check on executive impulses. And at a time when the executive is enormous and has a huge amount of power that's been delegated to it by Congress over the last 100 years, it's not fantastic. You do want Congress to sort of like play a large role in this as well, like the independent of the executive and their wishes.
Sometimes people say, well, why doesn't Congress do something about this? And sometimes I think they have a point that Congress is sort of not doing anything, and sometimes that's true of like oversight of certain things. In terms of like the war with Iran, I don't think Congress is not doing anything, and I think people say that are really just saying, why doesn't Congress agree with me and not Trump on this? We've had repeated votes where majorities in Congress have sided with the president on this, and like you can disagree with that. I disagree with that, but like that's not Congress not doing anything, which is Congress agreeing with the administration rather than disagreeing with the administration. If you just want Congress to disagree with the administration, you're asking for something different than for them to do something. There are times when they don't do something where I think they probably should. This is not one of them. This
Right.
is not one of them. They're just majorities in Congress that agree with the president about this. How long that lasts, I don't know. And I think, that's the other thing sort of floating on the horizon is that a lot of sort of, lukewarm Republican supporters of President Trump's military actions in Iran were hiding behind sort of the 60-day thing in the War Powers Resolution. Kind of probably hoping this thing wrapped up successfully in less than 60 days and they didn't have to sort of revise their opinions. Sure looks like they might have to revise their opinions now. And we may see some movement where we may see some members sort of shift away from that. We did see one thing I think we saw pretty early on, it might have been almost a month ago now, was members being skeptical about a war supplemental in terms of appropriations. And that is certainly Congress doing something. And it always strikes me too that people want Congress to quote unquote do something by passing a law, but merely like speaking out against a war supplemental, right? Severely constrains the administration. And if you want to know why Trump hasn't decided to launch some ground war in Iran, it could be public opinion, but what is Congress except the aggregated opinion of the public? And I think that sort of that, if you think the president has a free hand to do what he wants with the military in the Middle East right now, I think it's exactly the opposite. I think Trump is boxed in part because the support is so lukewarm in Congress for what's going on.
Right. I mean, and this is reflected in other ways too, right? Congress has gave a lot of scrutiny to some cabinet officials recently, and those cabinet officials are no longer cabinet officials, right? We've had three exits, and you say like, oh, well, Congress didn't do that. It's like, well, they were heavily involved. I mean, like it was sort of like there were a lot of signs. There's sort of like they weren't happy with the way that these things were running at DHS, at labor, at justice, and so Congress. And congressional actions really did play a role in those decisions, right? Maybe the president was the one who ultimately made the decision, but Congress is sort of heading that way and suggesting heavily, like, hey, we should find somebody else to be doing this job.
Cutting Bondi loose like 48 hours if she went and just twisted in the wind in Congress is just absolutely cold-blooded by the administration too. I mean, I have to think that they were near the end of the rope on her anyway, and just to force her to go up there and just get absolutely hammered like a punching bag right when they cut her loose is absolutely ice cold. But yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of strong arguments and good reason to believe that Congress has ceded a lot of power to the modern presidents in the last 15, 20 years, even above and beyond what we saw in the 20th century. But I also think the pendulum has swung almost too far the other way, where people believe Congress has virtually no influence in American politics. And I just think that's dead wrong.
Right.
And I, yeah.
There was a New York Times piece that came out, said Congress is, what was it? Congress is the weakest ever. And that was the same week that we let go of Noem, they let go of Bondi. They were talking about getting rid of Shabazz Rehman. I mean, like, all of these things were happening. Congress clearly just passed a ton of appropriations bills that forced agencies to rehire staff, that negated a bunch of reorganization plans, that put a bunch of like caveats and limitations on how money was going to be spent. I mean, Congress had really kind of stepped up more than it had been within the last year. And they're running stories that Congress is the weakest that it's ever been. And it's like, well, come on now, right? And that's just those two things don't go together. You
Yeah,
have to take it in totality.
I saw another commenter say something like, we have all these fighting over gerrymandering to control a legislature that doesn't govern and doesn't legislate. And I also think that's dead wrong too, right? I think the policy distinctions between, say, ARPA and the Inflation Reduction Act versus the Big Beautiful Bill are huge. Those are like huge policy differences in law, and those are directly downstream from partisan control of the legislature. And I to posit that Congress doesn't do anything and they're ineffective in the system, and therefore, sort of who controls Congress doesn't matter. Strikes me as an unbelievably naive view of sort of public policy, both administration policy and how that's shaped by Congress, but also just actual output legislatively of the United States government right now. This stuff really matters and a lot does happen. I think a better argument, and one that I actually sort of believe, is that controlling Congress is overrated because so much is bipartisan. And that a lot of lawmaking is bipartisan, and that's true whether the Republicans are in charge, the Democrats are in charge, whether they have unified government or divided government. And sort of that's sort of the big secret is that, yeah, you want to control Congress. There's lots of good things you can get if you control it, but a heck of a lot of important stuff is done on a bipartisan basis too.
Right. We just like talking about the partisan stuff most, right? At least that gets the most attention. All right.
I
So
mean, we
we all
do,
know,
yeah.
yeah, we all know nobody listens to a podcast after 43 minutes. So I guess we're gonna go ahead and wrap it up. Matt, you got any final thoughts?
No, I mean, I think we probably should just mention I spent a lot of time talking to reporters and other people, be it my family members or just, randos, about sort of expulsions in the House, and that knocking off four members in a week, which is, well, not three members in a week and a fourth sort of on the plank, is a big deal. I think it's good for the House. I think one unfortunate thing in sort of small D Democratic politics is that if a party sort of like makes a big stink to kick out its sort of immoral or otherwise corrupt members, like you would think, like if you were just thinking about it in a vacuum, you'd be like, oh, that's a good thing, right? That's good for the party, just get rid of its worst members. But actually, like in the way a democracy works, like that reflects badly on the party. And so that's one problem that we have sort of in the legislature, is that if you do the thing where you're like, okay, we're going to find all the dirty corrupt members and boot them, like you don't get credit for that as a party. In fact, you get sort of like the tarnish of it put on you. And that makes all of this much more complicated politically, and it incentivizes parties to sweep this stuff under the rug, but that's not changing. So,
Yeah,
any
no.
final word from you?
Well, I've just been I've been pleasantly surprised that Congress has taken this route, honestly, because for a long time it really did seem like nothing mattered, right? It was sort of like there are all these scandals and nobody cares. They just get back into Congress, and it's just like, like George Santos lied about literally everything and like got elected.
Said his mom died in 9/11. Like the Santos like lies are, you cannot make up a lie that's brazen enough to be on Santos, right?
And whether it was that or it was like a variety of different corruption charges that never, just didn't have any sort of effect on the member. You've seen Congress sort of like push back a little bit, and it's been good to see. I think that people need trust in their institutions, for the most part. I think it's, kicking these people out is actually maybe not building trust, but in the long run, I think it could help, right? I mean, you're seeing more and more members sort of feel the pressure to resign, whereas this was sort of a foregone conclusion. If like a scandal came out, you were expected to resign, right? Because the political pressures would be was sort of like, hey, so you're leaving, right? Kind of push you that direction. So I'm glad that we're taking a step back in this direction where resignations are becoming more normal. Yeah, there's a lot of rot to clear out, I would to say the least. All
All
right.
righty, man. Good talking to you.
Yep, you too.
All right.
We will be back at some point
Yeah,
in the
hopefully
near
soon.
future,
This is
hopefully.
proper. Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Take
Everybody
care.
have a good one.
Bye.